Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Online shopping is a breeze on the front end. Sit in your pajamas, point, click, and buy. On the back end, where those orders get filled, it's not so easy. In the fulfillment warehouses of the new online America, the pickers who run for products and fill the conveyor belts for all that fast, free shipping can have work lives that bring to mind the coal miners and textile workers of another age. Desperate work lives. This hour on Point, a window on work, the backside of online shopping. All right, we're going in there to warehouse world. Joining me first today from San Francisco is Mac McClellan, reporter for Mother Jones magazine. Her cover story in the current issue is, I was a warehouse wage slave, the secret hell of online shopping. Mac McClellan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What were the dimensions of this warehouse you worked in?
I can't say exactly for legal reasons, but it was several hundred thousand square feet. So, you know, walking around it from one end to another could take 20 minutes, probably. Plus, you have to go around all the conveyor belts and, you know, there's sort of forklifts whirring around and things like that. It's monstrous, and the ceilings are super, super high because all of the merchandise is kept on several levels. So it's massive.
And you got a job there. This is somewhere west of the Mississippi, is all you're telling us. But you got a job there as a picker. What's a picker, Mac?
A picker is a person who has to actually get the crap that you order. So if you order a Barbie doll, a picker is the person who has to go to the place in the warehouse. You're holding a little scanner with a computer on it, and
okay,
it gives you a code, like a code of a section and then a bin and a row and a level. You know, it's like 10 numbers in it because the organization is so, you know, it's such a vast space that there has to be all these numbers. You have to find where the object is, and then you go to the bin, and then in that bin there will be a bunch of other items, like 30 batteries, and then, you know, some Barbie dolls, maybe a CD or something, and you pick the item out, and you have to do it, you know, several times. Ideally, you would get a several in a minute. And so you just sort of run around this giant warehouse picking all the items up and then sending them off in little plastic totes onto a conveyor belt to another person whose job is to stand perfectly still and tape boxes closed all day.
So on one end of this, somebody sat in their pajamas, poked around online, find something they liked and said, I want that. On the other end, it's delivered by somebody to their front door, and in the middle is this giant warehouse. Now, the one you were in, some of these would be, I suppose, there are some that are just Amazon or just this or just that, but some of these, many of these are independent. They're kind of fulfillment centers that serve lots of different retailers, vendors. Was this one kind of product or all kinds of products that you were picking, Mac?
Well, this was all kinds of products. I mean, this would, even if you were in just an Amazon warehouse, obviously there would be all kinds of products from them.
Sure.
And then also places like Amazon, because they are so good at fulfilling, because they fulfill so many of their own orders, a lot of smaller companies pay Amazon to do their fulfilling for them. So if I'm a smaller company and I want to sell my stuff online, I can actually contract with Amazon, send them my merchandise, and have them do it for me. So in a lot of these places, you have mixed, you know, products from lots and lots of different companies.
I'm reading here in part of your big piece. So you got this job, you went in, you went to work there, you saw what it was, you did it. And I began reading thinking, well, you know, come on, she's walking around a warehouse, she's picking up products, she's putting them on a conveyor belt. I mean, it's boring work, but how hard could it be? By the time I finished your piece, I had a very different impression. I'm reading here at one point, you had an hour left in your day, and your day was a 10-hour day, I think, 10 and a half, something like that?
Yeah, they were 10.5-hour shifts.
Okay, so you had an hour left, and you had already raced around this monstrous, as you say, this gigantic warehouse. You had already picked 800 items, and your scanner was telling you that you had fulfilled only 52% of your goal at that point in the day. So they would like you to have picked at that point 1,600 items. Even 800 seemed kind of unbelievable. I mean, it sounds like you're almost speed walking or running all day long to get each of these products.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what you're doing. I mean, I agree with you. When I went in there, and you know, I used to work in warehouses. I worked for a moving and storage company for like 5 years. So, you know, I actually kind of like working in warehouses. And when I went in there and they gave me my assignment as a picker, I was like, this is going to be awesome. Like, I like running around.
Let's go. Let's do it. I can do this.
Yeah, right. And I actually, you know, I'm a nerd, so I really like organizing things into tidy little packages and things like that. So it seemed like totally up my alley. But then, you know, when it comes down to it and you actually have to run, like your scanner will tell you how many seconds it thinks you should take to get to the item. So a code pops up, you know, for you to go get whatever, a calendar with fairies on it or something. Mm-hmm. And then it will tell you like 25 seconds and it counts down as you're walking. And, you know, this place is huge. And so you are definitely speed walking. Or, you know, I broke into a jog. So you're not supposed to run mm-hmm. for safety purposes, but mm-hmm. everybody in there is walking as fast as a normal person jogs because that's the only way that you can possibly make your goals.
And at the end of that walk or that jog, you're coming to a series of shelves and bins. You're reaching up high or you're bending down low and you're doing that hundreds or maybe by their goals thousands of times in a day. I started off skeptical, but by the end of this, I was thinking, you know, how different is this from when we used to send down coal miners under the earth at very low wages to sort of work their brains out of sight of the sun for hours. And as you go on to tell us, for very, very low wages, and no matter how fast you do it, what they're sort of tracking your speed and they just ask for more.
Yeah, I mean, there's people who come around and tell you, you know, and the people who tell you how you're doing, you know, are regular people too. Like, they don't want to be mean about it, but it's their job to enforce these goals. It's not like corporate execs are the ones who are coming to tell you that you suck at your job. You know, it's just like a regular person like you. And so,
but the system is arranged to tell you how you are underperforming.
That's right. They have clipboards and they have numbers on them. And they'll, you know, they came up to me on my second day. You know, this person came up to me and was like, "You're doing a really bad job." And I was like, "I'm never doing a bad job, but I'm trying so hard." You know, it's almost impossible to keep up with the numbers that they want. Although there are people there who do it. You know, this one guy was telling me he always makes over 20% of his goals. And so he's picking, you know, probably close to 2,000 items in a 10.5-hour shift. And the only sort of reward that he gets for that, you know, because some people just really like to do a good job
yep,
at work.
Go,
no
go,
matter
go,
what
go,
their job
go,
is.
Go, go, yep.
Exactly. And he said, you know, sometimes they get company gift cards for like $15 as a, you know, as a reward
for
getting
picking
that
maybe
many more
2,000
items.
Products in a day. What about working conditions here? Wages. What were wages?
Well, I was hired at 11, like 11:25 or 11:50 an hour or something like that.
Okay.
It depends on what state you're in. It depends on which company you work for. But I also signed something when I started that said that if I didn't leave with at least a week's, you know, permission and notice that I was stopping my assignment, that my hours would be paid out at minimum wage. And, you know, minimum wage in most states is
seven,
just over
something.
$7.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that was why I was... I knew I wasn't going to leave with a week's worth of notice. So at the end of my second full, very long day, I was like, man, I just did all that. And it looks like I'm only going to make like $60
for this entire day.
For
all that picking. And that would be a 10.5-hour day. You were working what the week was Sunday through Thursday, I think. And it was coming up
yeah.
the holiday. So things were getting intense.
Yeah, it was Sunday through Thursday, 10.5-hour shifts. And then the next week, the week after I left, we were slated to start working a minimum of 12-hour shifts for 5 days in a row every week.
Job security?
Well, no, because I was actually hired by a temporary staffing company, and lots of these positions, that's part of the problem, is that lots of these positions are filled by temporary staffers. And they use the word temps very loosely. You could be a temp for like 2 years. I went to another warehouse like this that I didn't work in, but I just visited in Ohio last year, and they had temps, you know, quote unquote temps there, who'd been there for more than a year. But if you are a temp, you know, you don't have normal employees' rights. You don't have good insurance. We had a sort of an insurance program that we could buy into as temps, but basically all that it meant was that when we went to the doctor, you know, we had to pay like $300 instead of $500. It's not really, they call it a limited insurance program.
Right, right.
So you don't have decent insurance, you don't have vacation, you don't have paid time off. You know, you basically just don't have the normal things that people have. And plus, you can be fired at any time. This warehouse had 3,000 workers in it.
Wow.
And the temporary staffing company that I was hired by, you know, with the Christmas rush and everything, in the last 4 months of last year, they cycled through 4,000 people, because that's how fast they fire and hire. And, you know, at the end of Christmas or at the end of February or at the end of any moment when it turns out that the company doesn't need you anymore, you know, they only will pay the exact number of bodies that they need per day. And so you don't know, you know, when you're going to have work or how long your job is going to last for.
Efficiency is the word that hangs over everything here. This is the super efficient world of online shopping. And the back side of that, it may sound sort of clicky and sweet and clean, but Mac McClellan was right down in there where it actually happens. It is brutal work, but it's very contemporary. I was struck by how people know that they have a very vivid sense of how bad this work is. We'll look at that and much more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the backside of online shopping, the giant warehouses where all those orders get filled, and the backbreaking work people do there filling those orders. We point, click, and buy. They race with rock-bottom wages and often no job security to fulfill, and efficiency hangs over it all. It's just kind of a window into a world you may not ever have thought about. When people talk about free shipping, fast shipping, Mac, we've got a lot of response already online here. Chris says he read your article yesterday and wanted to throw up. He said the 1% want the 99% to be their slaves. Tara writes that she became a temp picking and packing worker. She lasted one day. She writes to us, "We had to walk about a quarter mile across the warehouse to the water fountain. Working there was bordering on inhumane and, in my opinion," she writes, "degrading." But here's David. He writes, "What a load of bull. I work in several of these warehouses as a vendor, and there's a vast accommodation and hand-wringing over employee safety. I sympathize with these folks, but this is very much entry-level work. Thank God for the jobs." What do you say, Mac?
I mean, safety is I don't think safety really addresses the main problem. I mean, there are safety problems in that, you know, like any warehouse that has a bunch of automated machinery in it, you know, you can hurt yourself, and so you're supposed to be careful around that.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Sure, and we didn't really have time, you know, to be careful, and so they would tell us, like, there are all these points in the floor where people trip and sprain their ankles. They have a lift, like an industrial lift, that if you are carrying a cart, you have to put it in, and one of the arms had been installed wrong on it, and
okay,
three people in the last month had been clocked by it and had to get stitches in their head and all this stuff. So safety is kind of an issue. Obviously is an important issue, but the bigger issue is the general treatment of these people. I mean, like that, you know, like one of your callers was saying, it's far, you know, just to go get a drink of water. They estimated that the pickers in this warehouse walked an average of 12 miles a day. And that includes, you know, your two little breaks when you get to run to the break room at the front and go through these metal detectors to make sure you're not stealing anything. And then you have 6 minutes to try to eat something or drink something as fast as you possibly can and then run back to the other side. And all of these jobs are done at terribly, you know, not body friendly, just like awful ergonomical standards. It's so nice, you know, when your scanner shows a code that means that you are going to pick an item that is, you know, eye level,
right,
or waist level.
Right.
But that's pretty rare. Usually,
and by the end
you have
of the
to get
day,
down
by,
on your knees.
Right. By that 1,000th product or 1,500th product, getting down on your knees can seem like a long way.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I consider myself to be in pretty good shape, and I'm not that old. You know, I'm 31, and there were people in here, a lot of people who were in their 50s and 60s, and I literally did not understand how they were doing it, and they all kept telling me that I wasn't taking enough Advil, and I just needed to, you know, take painkillers of some sort or another in order to deal with the joint pain and the muscle pain and things like that. And I think that that's not really a practical way to expect people to live for a long period of time. And people have been emailing me since we put this story up on motherjones.com yesterday, and people have been emailing me, you know, this 22-year-old girl emailed me and said, I started working there when I was 19, I had to leave, and I still have this grinding noise in my shoulder every time I move my arm from, you know, the repetitive and just bad movements that I was making on a daily basis. It's real lasting damage.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this, listening. Some will be incredibly sympathetic. Others, like our other, listener will say, come on, these are jobs. I mean, again, I came in thinking, well, of course, there's always been entry-level difficult jobs. But then you describe a lot of, middle-aged, older people, retired people working here. And you describe how within a couple of days, though conversation is not encouraged, there are little snippets that take place, and people do have a very vivid sense that the question that people ask each other is, why are you here? What happened to you that you have to work here and let people treat you like this? There's a very vivid sense that this is right at the edge of what constitutes humane work and maybe beyond it, and people are very conscious of that in the warehouse.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, like we were talking about before, working in a warehouse is not necessarily, you know, most people's dream job, but working in a warehouse can be a totally fine job. You know, you go to work and you get it done and you leave it in the warehouse and then you go home and that's the end of it. And that's totally fine. And this warehouse job does not have to be as bad as it is. It does have to be as bad as it is if you want to have companies that post profits in the millions and billions, but not pay for shipping and, you know, not have their customers pay for shipping and deeply discount their merchandise. I mean, that money has to come from somewhere. If you think about how profitable those companies are, of course that money has to come from somewhere. And it comes out by wringing, you know, as much as possible out of the people who actually have to ship and handle these items.
Mac McClellan writes about it all in Mother Jones. You can link to her article at our website, onpointradio.org. Mac, we've got a lot of callers with some experience in this realm. Jeremiah in Winchester, Virginia. Jeremiah, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you know?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
All right. What's your experience, Jeremiah?
Where do I begin? I'm currently a warehouse worker. I've worked for some temp agencies I don't understand how they get away with being in business. I really don't.
Describe it to us. What's the work like?
The work, you are like a slave, and you have to do whatever you're told. You have to sacrifice your life, your own personal values. So it sucks.
How does your work experience compare to what you're hearing Mac McClellan describe here, Jeremiah?
Oh, I think I was just telling the gentleman, I think she's lucky. I know that her situation and her experience wasn't great, but I think I'm east of the Mississippi here, and the wages are a lot less, and the hours are a lot more, up to 16 hours a day. And you have to turn right around and be back in for your next shift in the morning.
16 hours a day. What kind of wage?
Starting at $9.
And I don't know. I mean, what kind of pace of work? How many trucks in the dock at a time waiting to be loaded?
Oh, 40, 50, 60. Well, there's a place here in town that has over 100 docks, and that's thousands of people.
Why do you do this job? Why not get a better one?
These jobs are hard to find, one. Two, if you need quick cash, you need a paycheck by the end of the week, you go get a job today.
How long do you think you can do it? How long do you think you can keep it up?
Before, like, your body shuts down.
Maybe.
Your mental capacity diminishes.
Yeah.
A couple months.
Oh, boy. Jeremiah, good luck with it. We'll be thinking of you right there, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Wilmore, Kentucky. David's calling. Hi, David. You're on the air with Mac McClellan.
Yeah, Tom. I don't know what I'm at a disadvantage because I haven't read the woman's article.
Okay.
I will make a point of doing that after the show here.
It's good.
But I just strongly believe that now maybe not all warehouses are equal. I don't know about saying company names on the air, but the company I work for is very, very large.
Okay.
And my wife also works for, and I have from 6 years or so.
And do you work, David, you and your wife, do you work as pickers like Mac did in this warehouse?
I don't do much picking anymore. Sometimes during the busy season, I train pickers.
How about your wife?
Yeah.
How about your wife?
Pardon?
How about your wife?
My wife primarily picks and sometimes runs problem solve.
And how old are you guys?
My wife is 58 and I'm 61.
In a given, I don't know, shift, how many miles do you think she goes in that warehouse?
Oh, 12, 14, somewhere like that.
And how many products might she pick off the shelves and get on the conveyor belt?
Well, rate is $13.50 a night.
$1,350 a night.
That would be 100%.
And does she make 100%?
Oh, pretty regular.
So what do you think of it? Is this you know, hell on earth? Is this a wage slave work? Is this just the way it is? How do you look at it?
It's not an easy job. I think one of the little mottos they have is work hard, have fun, make history. And to do that, the whole idea is that you're in there with a goal to get this product out. If someone says, if someone goes to a website and the website says, have this by, you know, tomorrow morning if you order in the next 12 hours or something, the whole idea is to get that product off the shelf and into a box and into a truck and at that person's door in that period of time to meet what we promised the customer.
So, I mean, you know, the case Mac is making, when you say that, you know, I was a wage slave, she's making the case that this is inhumane work at some point, and people are only doing it because they have no other choice, and there's so little job security, as a temp, of course, and wages are low, and the demands are, like, off the charts, and nobody could or should do this for very long. Are you arguing with that, David?
Yeah, I would argue with that. I think it's... Yeah, I know some people aren't up to it, and initially when they started out to pick her, they only work them half shifts, just you know for the first 4 days, just to get them
break them in
the flow of it, because mm-hmm. you have to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But once you got it, you know it's pretty smooth, and they're constantly trying to improve. And they do stress safety, they do stress ergonomics, and getting your body in shape, and something like that. I mean, you know, you can still come home a little sore. My wife was just mentioning when she heard the lady talking about the shoulder. She said, well, you know, my shoulder did hurt a little bit this morning. You know, but
58 years old, I'm sure it does some mornings. I'm sure it does. David, I so appreciate your call. Hey, Mac, in San Francisco, what do you say? You know, maybe you're just not cut out for it. Maybe you just don't have the juice.
I mean, that guy's wife is my hero. I don't know how she... I mean, I didn't understand how anybody... I mean, you could make your goals. I mean, I sort of have... Of course, I have the luxury of not needing to keep this job for a long period of time.
Yeah.
But I was still moving as fast as I could. I'm sure if I had been there for, like, 3 weeks, I would have gotten, you know, used to it enough that I could have been able to do it, but it still would have hurt. I mean, I don't... think that these jobs should exist. I think people are going to buy things on the internet, and I think that's fine. But if you would just hire more people so that instead of picking 1,350 items a day, which is absurd, you just picked like 800, you know, or a more reasonable number. And when he's talking about, you know, make history, we had the same kind of ridiculous...
Go.
They would, you know, put... Mm-hmm. Right, like they'd put up letters from customers where customers were saying like, oh my God, thank you so much for making my product arrive at my house within 36 hours.
Yeah, and, I mean, it is amazing oftentimes. I've been amazed at that.
Totally.
But I'd never thought about, you know, somebody like running their brains out in some giant warehouse to make that happen. It's just magic. It shows up. It's boom.
It is. It is absolutely amazing. I mean, you could still do that. You could still have, I'm not advocating, like, I wish it took 10 weeks for products to arrive at my house. That's great when it arrives in 36 hours. But if you had more people filling those orders, people with more reasonable goals, you know, then it wouldn't have to be so taxing and so demanding on the people who were doing it. It's just a matter of, you know, having to actually pay more people and pay them decently to do this really hard work.
And not make it inhumane. But they don't, as you say, because profits are higher when they squeeze absolutely to the limit and people are willing to take the jobs like David and his wife because those are the jobs there are. Mac McClellan with Mother Jones, stand by there in San Francisco. Joining us right now from Allentown, Pennsylvania, Spencer Soper. He's a business reporter for the newspaper there, The Morning Call. He wrote an investigative article last fall titled Inside Amazon's Warehouse. Lehigh Valley, that's outside Allentown there. Workers tell of brutal heat, dizzying pace at online retailer. Spencer, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
And I should say, there's a link to your story as well at our website, onpointradio.org, and it's also pretty incredible. What did you hear was going on in this Amazon warehouse? What were the facts, Spencer?
Well, it sounds a lot like what the other guest described, very rapid production pace. But I think a big thing that we found was a lot of people were very excited at first. The economy is poor. We have, high unemployment. Jobs are few and far between.
Yep.
And one woman in particular I can think of, when you posed the question earlier, Tom, about, you know, how did I end up here? Why do I do this?
Yep.
Well, there was one woman we interviewed where she was a receptionist for a home building firm, and obviously the home building industry imploded.
Yeah.
And so she, you know, she was one of these people out there looking for work and took one of these jobs in this warehouse. And most of the people we interviewed were excited at first. It was like, wow, you know, I'm looking for a job, and I have an opportunity to work at Amazon. And they're hired through a temporary staffing firm, but the advertisements are worded in a manner like chart your career to Amazon through Integrity Staffing Solutions or whatever, kind of, making the applicant believe that this might lead to something. They're getting on
yep.
the bottom rung of a ladder with a big global powerhouse that could lead somewhere, but that the longer these people did these jobs, the more disillusioned they became, and very few of them actually achieve full-time employment. Many of them simply work, you know, several months and are either their assignment runs out or they are dismissed for some infraction or another.
And you're talking about $11 or $12 an hour, as you describe it, in the summer there, in brutal heat, 102 degrees in parts of this warehouse. People work
yes.
pushed, you're describing here, at a pace that they could not sustain. Employees frequently reprimanded on productivity, threatened with termination. They don't hit the mark, escorted out of the warehouse. And during summer heat waves, looking at your piece here, Spencer, Amazon arranged to have paramedics parked in ambulances outside, no AC inside, but ambulances outside ready to treat workers who were dehydrated or suffered from heat stress, put on stretchers and wheelchairs, taken off to hospitals. And I think I got the impression that oftentimes that was also the end of their work there. I mean, they were fired.
Yes, well, oftentimes people either that would discourage them from returning or if they did come back, people could even be penalized for leaving a shift early.
With heat stroke.
The burden is on you. Amazon has disputed that, but we've heard from other people, that they could be penalized, maybe for saying they were not feeling well. There's requirements to have like a doctor's note, and that sort of thing. And some have mentioned how they don't have very good health insurance, or if they're temp firm, they have pretty crummy health insurance that many people just simply don't opt into.
I mean, it's a high-tech kind of entry point here with the online order, but the reality of it, even if it's in a well-lit warehouse, it can sound very 19th century, Spencer, like something out of Dickens.
Well, one man in particular that I interviewed, he's in his 50s, and he worked at the warehouse for several months. And I've met him at his home, and he has a garden, and he's in good shape. He's not a slouch. And we talked about his time there. He worked in the warehouse for several months. And his problem was the area of the warehouse where he worked, it was dimly lit. And so we have this rapid production expectation. And then his vision is not great. He has to find sometimes small items, maybe a DVD or a romance novel with script writing on it.
And do it fast. Spencer, stand by. We've got a break right here. Spencer Soper with The Morning Call in Allentown. Mac McClellan, this is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the backside of online shopping, the giant warehouses where all those orders get filled, and the really tough work people do there filling those orders. We point and click and buy. They race with very low wages, often very little job security, to fulfill those orders maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000 times a day. We've got such a range. We're going to hear from in just a moment from a labor historian, but get a little context for this. But such a range of response here. I mean, here we got online, one listener writes, look, everyone goes through crazy part-time job. What a disappointment that the youth today has forgotten what hard work means. There's one reaction. Here's another. GQ writes, this is just the Chinification of America. This is why workers at Foxconn in China jumped to their deaths. This is just inhumane. On the other hand, Jason writes on Twitter, this is a waste of my morning. Hearing people complain about working hard is not news. And Greg is wondering, is there any such thing as entry-level work these days? Does anyone work up the ranks to the top anymore, or is it all this kind of tough stuff at the bottom? I mean, Spencer, Mac and I have talked about it a little, but what do you make of that range of reactions here? People say, come on, it's a hard job. Get in there and do it and get a better job later.
It's a common reaction. It's also, you know, generally spoken by people who have not worked there. We interviewed a large number of people. We interviewed people who have come from a variety of backgrounds and industries, people who have done physical work. We're no stranger to physical work. But the idea of entry-level job, that is the exactly what we're talking about. There's an idea that this may lead to something. And for most, it leads nowhere. It leads to termination. So if you're doing this job and you're trying to meet your productivity goals, and even if you are reaching your productivity goals, the bottom line is this is a seasonal business. We have crunch time during the holidays where they need a lot of people, and afterward they won't need as many. And so many of them will be, discarded. So it's the idea that, okay, it's an entry-level job, people don't understand the dynamic at play here. A lot of the workers taking the jobs hope it's an empty entry-level job, but it turns out to be a dead-end street.
Hey, Mac, you know, a lot of people have jobs that seem endless. They go on forever. I used to work as a janitor in a giant, giant steno pool hall, you know, big as the eye could see back in the day. And, I could clean and clean and never be done. I used to work in a gravel crusher, a big steel contraption, and my job that crushed stone, loud as you can imagine. My job was to stand in the middle of it with a shovel and shovel the crushed gravel away from the gears so it wouldn't, you know, all grind to a halt. I mean, the volume was unbelievable. The work was unending. On the other hand, it was a union job, and I got paid a lot more than you were getting paid in your warehouse, Mac.
I mean, I was thinking the exact same thing that Spencer just said. People who say, you know, it's the value of hard work or whatever, you just don't understand. I mean, you know, I worked in a warehouse. I was a mover for 5 years and a house cleaner for years after that. I've had manual labor jobs for way longer in my life than I've had this, you know, reporting job. And so I know that kind of work. I know what it's like, and I liked it, actually, when I did it. I don't think that the problem is that people should just not have to do physical labor anymore. I think physical labor, you know, can be great, really, and I think it's a great job for a lot of people. You have to understand just the conditions in these particular places, the goals and how unrealistic they are, the fear of the people that they are not going to make them and they're not going to have jobs anymore, just the constrictions that they have on their personal lives. You know, they are totally at the mercy of whatever these particular companies need at the moment. You know, they're not allowed to take holidays off in a lot of cases and things like this. You really just have to understand the whole picture of it. This is not about, you know, Americans shouldn't have to do hard work anymore. That is definitely not the issue.
And whatever you do, somebody advised you, don't let them see you cry. If you cry, they may fire you. Mac McClellan and Spencer Soper stand by. Bob Korstad joins us right now from Durham, North Carolina. He's a professor of public policy and history, Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. He's co-director there of the program on history, public policy, and social change. He's author of Civil Rights Unionism, Tobacco Workers and the Struggle for Democracy in the Mid-20th Century South. No stranger to situations of hard work and people doing a lot of it. Bob Korstad, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Put this in some context for us, Bob. I mean, you hear what Max describing the work she did for her reporting, the reporting Spencer has done on a big warehouse that fulfills for Amazon outside of Allentown, Pennsylvania. Where does this sit in the context of American labor, labor history, you know, quality of life, quality of work? What are you thinking as you hear this, Bob?
Well, these stories sound very much like those of workers I interviewed who labored in the textile and the tobacco industry in the early parts of the 20th century. I remember stories of women having really be scalped by machines in the textile industry when their hair got caught in them, the kinds of injuries that that Mac is recounting, heat in summer, cold in winter, the kind of intrusion in the wet restrooms. And the tobacco and textile factories, it would be foremen coming in and telling the women, you know, it's time to
Let's
get out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's a stopwatch that you're worrying about. So, you know, these were conditions in the early part of the 20th century.
But that's a century ago. Is it strange to you that we've still got it? And Max writing about how she's being warned in this job, don't get too close to the conveyor belt. Your hair gets caught in there. It will scalp you.
Well, it doesn't surprise me given the kinds of changes that have taken place in the labor force and in labor law in the last 30, 40 years. I mean, as you mentioned, you had a union job. Well, none of these jobs are union jobs, and the percentage of workers who are in unions today is at really an all-time low, at least in the 21st century. We've got weak labor laws. There's virtually no enforcement in some places of environmental and workplace safety laws. You've got a weak labor market. So people are really pushed into circumstances very much like those workers that I interviewed who were coming off the farms. Working in textiles and tobacco was the only thing they could do to make a living. And they just had to they kind of had to suck it up and do what was required. And, we had hoped we'd gotten past those kinds of working conditions in this country, but we seem to be going backwards rather than forwards.
You know, what we're willing to accept always changes according to circumstance. And we get used to things and then we get past things and maybe they come back. I mean, if you put, American workers from 72 into this situation, would they have tolerated it, or would they have said this doesn't cut it in our country, or have people always done work like this?
Well, if you look back in 1972, it was one of the moments the highest number of wildcat strikes in the United States, and actually overall strikes by union workers. And so those were times when they were actually resisting these same kinds of efforts. And they could do that because the job market was better. They had strong unions. They had a National Labor Relations Board that was more responsive. Workers are on the defensive in the United States, and it's not just because loss of jobs overseas, but these are conditions that exist in many sectors of the American economy.
More response online here. Steve writes, when somebody says they should be happy for the job, that person should be asked the last time they worked 10 to 12 hours a day for days on end at full speed with limited breaks. Jim writes, I just dumped my Amazon stock. Well, okay, I don't know. Mark in Cambridge, Massachusetts is calling. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Mac, I actually read your article just yesterday, and I was just struck by just the kind of conditions people are working under here in America. And I took out sort of an envelope and did some back-of-the-envelope calculations, and I realized that with about 1,000 items maybe being picked per shift, maybe an average of a 10-hour shift, that means people are being paid about 10 cents an item. That's it, 10 cents an item to be picked. And it got me thinking, what about an extra nickel? Is that much? And we talk about these profits of in the millions and billions. And, I don't think it's an either-or. I don't think it's a zero-sum game. I mean, I think these profits of in the millions and billions can still exist, and these workers can maybe be paid a little bit more.
An extra nickel a product, the way you're calculating it there, Mark, and that would be like a 50% hike. So that'd be maybe $18 an hour instead of 11. That'd be pretty great.
Exactly. Or you could give them only an extra couple bucks an hour and cut down the number of items they have to pick, and that might even make them happier. Give them $12 or $13 or $14 an hour and reduce the number of items they have to pick by 25 or 30%.
Yeah, Mark, I'm glad you're doing the math on this. Spencer, you've talked to Amazon and others about this business on your reporting there in Pennsylvania. I mean, can anybody do that? Or if they raise their wages or cut the pace of work by just a fraction, do they get undercut by somebody else 100 miles down the road?
Well, Amazon didn't really speak with us. They just sent us statements, very you know, carefully worded statements. So we did not really interview them about why they operate the way they operate, or if they could operate in a better manner. They did not want to have that interview. But I would another thing I just wanted to mention.
Yeah.
We talked about treatment, and a lot of people are like, "Oh, your work's hard. So what?" Another thing that we uncovered after our initial story, we heard from some more workers about some instances that happened the previous year over the winter, where there were a number of false fire alarms, and police thought that the fire alarms were linked to theft. So people were pulling the fire alarm and sneaking out with some items. And again, we're talking a couple of bad apples in this very large bunch of thousands of workers. But the way it was handled is the workers were forced to stand outside. Many of them wearing shorts and T-shirts, even on a winter shift, because it's warm, and you've heard how physical these jobs are.
Right.
Outside, huddled for hours at a time in 20-degree weather. And again, many of them have needing medical attention, transported to hospitals. And one man we interviewed described how the ambulance pulled in to get these workers who were stuck huddled outside. And again, it's like, well, so what? There was a fire alarm. What are they supposed to do? Workers were asking, can we go to our cars and get warm?
Yeah.
They were not allowed to. They weren't
sort of treated like cattle then.
It wasn't explained to them why they couldn't go to their cars, and they all surmised, well, it's because they think we're stealing something. So again, the company's saying, you know what, you're in shorts and T-shirt, stand out here. If anybody goes to your car, you're going to get fired. You can get fired. So they're forced to stand out there.
Yep.
And then some of them needed medical attention. And then when the ambulances came in to pick up workers, other workers huddled around the ambulance's engine compartment.
Wow.
Collecting the warmth.
I mean, again, it sounds 19th century. Chase writes online, it sounds like we need to invoke some John Rawls. Although these are entry-level positions, the people are treated in such a way ought to inflame our moral sensibilities. But reaction is all over the board on this. Maria in Iowa City. Maria, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to comment that I've worked a lot of different kinds of factory jobs, waiting table jobs. My husband's been in the moving industry, walking up a slide board when it's raining outside, worried about slipping and falling.
Sure.
When you're not a journalist and you're working at these jobs and this is what puts food on your table,
mm-hmm.
run a little faster, you work a little harder. And it's not entry level because there's not really the upward mobility. But if you want upward mobility, then you go to school at night, you go to school, work part-time, you do other things to try to find a different, better quality of life. And if you can't, then this is the job that you have.
And it's your reality, and you're living with it. Bob Corsted, I mean, there's the argument. Come on, don't complain so much. Go to school, get a better job.
Well, if people had those attitudes all through history, we wouldn't be very far. I mean, one of the reasons we have a middle class in this country is we had a strong labor movement in the 1930s, 1940s, and 50s who demanded health care, they demanded education for their children, they demanded homes for themselves. It seems to me that this kind of desire for a better way of life and organizing and fighting for it is one of the things that has made America a prosperous nation that has this huge middle class. And if everybody just sits back and say, well, this is the best it's going to be, and there's nothing I can do about it, then there's not very much hope for the future.
Mac McClellan, what about any later labor movement in your big warehouse?
Certainly, I never heard anybody talking about labor when you only have 29 minutes and 59 seconds to eat lunch, including the time it takes you to walk into the lunchroom and get through the metal detectors. You don't really have time to socialize that much. And since, it would be almost impossible to unionize under these kinds of conditions, which I'm sure, is part of the design, because you have so many workers coming and going so fast. They work such long hours that they, you have to get in there and you have to get out and then get home so that you can get ready to come right back again.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be, I never heard anything like that, but it would be so hard to orchestrate, but would that's what it needs.
The
that's
conveyor
really what
belt
it needs.
Really
needs
moves. One more call here. Kathy in Omaha. Our time is short, Kathy, but you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for touching on this topic. I think the thing that this brings to life for me is that we really live in an economy that is a relationship with each other. And I'm wondering what you think about publishing the true cost of the savings. Because what you're saying is that if I take a $7 savings on my free shipping, what's it really costing to worker health and well-being?
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of far removed from the products we buy and what goes on to bring us at that savings. But, I mean, Bob Korstedt, can you imagine Americans saying, oh, never mind the free shipping, I'll pay it so that somebody in a warehouse somewhere west of the Mississippi can have a little easier day?
Well, that'll be okay for some people, but, you know, there are thousands of people, including these people who work in these warehouses, they can't afford to buy the things that they're actually shipping out. So ultimately, that's going to have a negative effect on the economy, and we're all going to suffer from this.
Spencer, where do you think this goes? I mean, you've got a big, vigorous Amazon there. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. This is their business. Maybe it goes to robotics. Maybe that's the answer, Spencer, but then there's no job.
Yeah, I don't know where it's going, but I know I'm here too, and we're still looking. And if I could take 1 second, Tom, to respond to something that an earlier caller
said. 20 seconds here, yeah.
Journalist, you don't understand this or that.
Yeah.
I think Mac has described her work background as fairly physical. Mm-hmm. I myself have done that as well. I understand upward mobility. When I got started in the news business, I worked part time for a newspaper 2 days a week. I worked 3 days a week digging ditches with a landscaping crew. I worked my weekends on a golf course carrying golf bags. I understand.
You know what it is.
I understand upward mobility. I don't sit behind my desk. And even in the news business, yes, we leave the office. I've walked up mountains by the light of a cell phone.
Amen.
I think there is an assumption that some people listening to this think, oh, we're like silver spoon in the mouth journalists who sit behind a desk all day and hobnob.
I'm not seeing that. Spencer, we're out of time. We take your point. Spencer Soper with The Morning Call. Thank you for your work. Mac McClellan, thanks especially for yours with Mother Jones. Bob Korstedt at Duke, thanks a lot. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.